So I am actually recording the screen, so hopefully people at least will get the screen recording. It's not clear to me because I think there's an extended laptop thing going on. But we'll see, something will hopefully work. Okay, so what I am going to do is continue from the last class, which is we were talking last time about value iteration, right? And then basically the fact that you can compute the value of the expected, the maximal value, optimal value of each of the states essentially by using the Bellman equation as if it is an update rule, okay? So the Bellman equation itself was here. And that was essentially combining, it was saying that the optimal value of a node is related to the optimal values of its neighbors. That's what we're saying, okay? Except it is in terms of, it's in terms of this, considering all possible things you can do from that state, and then for each of the things you will get into the neighbors, and the neighbors have already their values, and then you're going to take which is the maximal expected value, and then with respect to that, and you add that to the reward that must correspond to your current value. Okay. So we talked about the value iteration and the fact that if you use that same equation as an update rule, then you would get the, after some number of iterations, the value vector would converge, okay? And then we also talked about the fact that the convergence would be different in different states, and if they're closer to sync states, then basically their value would already converge faster. Ones that are farther away, their value is likely to converge slower. Okay. That much is fine, and then we also talked about how it doesn't have to go synchronously, iteration by iteration. It can actually do it asynchronously by considering some states more often than other states, okay? And also, you don't need to use your neighbor's previous iteration values. If their values improved, then you essentially just take their current values. So suddenly, you might wind up having some neighbors whose values are from the 15th iteration, who, and some neighbors whose values are from the 7th iteration, and you combine them to get your current value. And as long as you update your value, update each state's value infinitely often, then you are guaranteed to converge. Okay? And then it turns out that normally this asynchronous approach might actually be much faster than the synchronous approach. Okay? Then I also mentioned last class that there is another way of doing this, which is the policy iteration. So the idea here is that, by the way, for the value iteration, when is it supposed to stop? It is supposed to stop as soon as value in two different iterations, value vector hasn't changed enough, and that's between two vectors. And you could take the maximum difference in any dimension and drive that down. When it becomes lower than certain value, then you stop. Okay. But however, the number of values in the value vector are, the number of value vector configurations is infinite. Okay. But the number of policies are finite because it's just, for these domains, right, the number of policies are finite because you have discrete actions. If you have continuous actions, policies also can be infinite. I mean, turn 21.3 degrees, turn 21.37 degrees, you can have all that stuff. But since these are all, essentially discrete action, you have a discrete number of policies. So what must be happening is that for ranges of value vector, there is one policy. That's the only way it would make sense, right? If you have only finite number of policies and infinite number of value vectors, then for ranges of value vectors, it is in one optimal one policy. that's basically the idea, is that, you know, whether or not which neighbor, think about, you know, first of all, MDPs are just generalizations of deterministic search. Okay, so if the actions are deterministic, then imagine that, you know, all the actions, none of them are stochastic. Then to try to figure out what your value is, what Bellman equation is saying is, take your current reward and see what are all the actions you can do. Each of them will deterministically take you to one of your neighbors. Look at which, whose value is better, and take that. Now, if your neighbors have, let's say, 2, 3, 4 versus 2, 3, 3.9, your choice is the same. You will always go to the third neighbor. As long as the third neighbor is better than the first and second, you will always go towards the third neighbor. So whichever action takes you there is what you will pick. Okay, that's the intuition. Okay, so basically, if in fact value vector, if you only have two states, then you can think of what is happening as the value vector, it's a two-dimensional vector, and there are regions in this two-dimensional space, and for each region there is one policy. Okay, and so the idea would then be that there is in fact an optimal value function, okay, except pretty much any of the values in this region, you would get the optimal policy. Okay, so policy iteration, what it tries to do is essentially start with a policy, compute the best value corresponding to that policy, and then assuming that as the value, change the policy. Okay, it looks almost like a, you know, circular reasoning, but it works because of this. Okay, so basically here is the steps in the policy iteration. You start with any arbitrary policy, so you can, for example, set every state to go left, for example, okay, or you just randomly set the direction it should go to, okay, and then once I know the policy, I do this loop. Okay, I start with the initial policy and I do this loop where until the policy doesn't change between two iterations, I keep going through this loop. In this loop, I first compute the values given the policy. Now, how do you do that? That's actually basically what we were saying earlier, that here, if I am given the policy, then I can do this equation, except I don't need the max because I know exactly which action I'll be doing. So computing the value given policy is solving a set of linear equations. Okay, so you can do it exactly if you want. Okay, so we'll first assume that we will do it exactly, but then I'll tell you later on that you don't even need to do that. So computing the utilities given a policy is just solving these linear equations. Okay, and once you solve the linear equations, you will get the actual values, you know, for each of the states, neighbors. Now you'll ask the neighbors to look around, I mean each state to look around and see whether it's doing the right thing given what its neighbors' values are. So forget about what you are supposedly doing in this state. Just look around your neighbors and figure out what your optimal action is. Now remember that the optimal action can always be decided by looking at the values of the neighbors, looking at your current possible actions, take the expected value of doing each of the actions, and pick the value that has the maximum expected value. Okay, in the deterministic case, all I am saying is that if you thought you wanted to go high up, you know, up, okay, but based on the values, you actually realize that the going right gets you to a state which has a higher value, now you just change to going right. So you ignore what you were thinking of doing before. You just look at your neighbors once again and look at your policy. Okay, and if you do that, then you have a new policy. And then go through the loop. So again, recompute the values given the policy. And then recompute the policy given the values until policy doesn't change between two iterations. Okay, if you do that, in essence, what you're doing is you're making these discrete steps through this region. Okay, and you will never, basically, you are not staying in any region, you know, so you're getting one policy from each of the regions until you get to the optimal region. That's basic idea. Okay, and what's interesting is that in fact the number of iterations needed is much fewer for policy iteration than for value iteration. not surprisingly. Okay, of course, per iteration cost is actually higher here because you are solving, in each iteration, you are solving a whole bunch of linear equations. But it turns out there is a way out of that too. You don't actually need to solve the linear equations if you don't feel like it. You can use iterative methods. Okay, so for example, you can, instead of thinking of that as an equality, think of it as an update rule. So instead of Bellman update, you do policy update of the value a bunch of times. Okay, it turns out this is a way of solving linear equations. Okay, and so basically we can either solve linear equations exactly or solve them approximately by running the value iteration a few times. Except you are running the value iteration without the max operation. You're just taking, you know, the action that you're supposed to be doing in that state. Do you see what I'm saying? So either you can do the actual equation solving or you can do value iteration, a stripped down version of the value iteration to improve the policy iteration. Okay. Overall, policy iteration, for example, one of the interesting things these two curves show is, in a way, the amount of error that your policy, I mean, that the value function has in terms of number of iterations of the value iteration versus number of iterations of the policy iteration. And the policy iteration sort of falls down very quickly and stays. Value iteration very slowly gets to the optimal value. That's basically because as soon as you get into this region, you would have got the optimal policy. Whereas in the value iteration, you will go creep from here to here to here to this particular thing. Because it doesn't look at whether or not the policy is changing. Okay? So those are the fundamental ideas for solving Markov decision processes, value iteration and policy iteration. Okay, so what we will do in a minute is actually there are a million ways of changing these small ideas to get a million different improved ideas for solving MDPs. Okay, but one thing you have to remember is all of what we have done till now is at what level of representation? At the atomic level. So now you understood how to do MDPs at the atomic level. So you should now try to do it at the factored or propositional or relational level or first order level. I won't talk much about it because the paper is still being written on them. Okay. Basically, propositional MDP solvers are already there. Okay, but relational and first order are basically still under construction. Okay. So in some sense, you can do relational planning, which is basically a deterministic version of MDP, but you still can't do relational. I mean, you still don't have, we have some understanding, but not complete understanding of how to do relational MDPs, where you have stochastic actions. Okay? The other thing I want to do to connect it up to what we were saying earlier is that remember that I got into this whole Markov decision processes by talking about partial satisfaction planning. That is, if you have deterministic planning and if you have actions with cost, goals with utilities, then that's a different kind of a planning. But then that turns out to be special case of Markov decision processes because goals with utilities is general reward structure. The only thing that we didn't talk about in talking about the MDPs till now is actions with costs. What about the action cost? Okay, it turns out it's very easy to extend the model to deal with action cost. Okay, and this is the equation if you have actions with cost. So in general, basically, apart from getting the reward of the state, here this is the part where you are deciding which action to do, right? Each action costs something for doing it in that state. Plus, it will then take you into other states with some probability. And you need to, and once you get to those states, you'll get a reward of that state. Okay, assuming everything is in the same currency, if the values, if the rewards and the costs are in the same currency, you can put a minus cost here and then get the utility you get here, utility in terms of immediate reward. Right? So that's basically what you wind up writing your utility as. Okay? So if you do that, then it's basically all you're having is a cost metric, and once you do that, you essentially at least have, at the atomic level, how to do partial satisfaction planning. It turns out there are much better ways of doing partial satisfaction planning when you don't have stochastic actions, okay, more efficient ways, but at least you know what it becomes. It's just a special case of deterministic MDPs. Okay? That's basically what that was saying. Okay, so what I'm going to do now is to look at a different way of solving MDPs. This is a directional shift in the sense, until, you know, in policy iteration and value iteration, you're trying to compute the optimal policy. And then presumably you will start executing it. Okay, now policy, it turns out that the value iteration and policy iteration are only polynomial complexity in the space of states. And states are exponential in the space, you know, there are exponential number of states if you have, you know, given number of state variables. So obviously all we are saying is value and policy iteration are polynomial in the space of states, means they're exponential in general in the, you know, in the representation that you think of, which is propositional representation. Right? Okay, so if you can take a long time to actually compute the optimal policy sometimes, right? So the question is, what if you don't have the time? What if you need to decide very quickly what to do? Now, I am talking about it with respect to Markov-Decision processes now, but I could have asked this question pretty much all through the semester. You try to do A star search, find the optimal path, and then start executing it. What if you don't have time to find the optimal path? What if you have to make a decision currently in the state that you are in? You probably have less time than is needed to find the optimal path. Okay, so what we will do is basically you need real-time search. Real-time search where you are given a few seconds and then where you look around where you are and then try to look at your neighbors and see which neighbor should I pick. And then I do it. And if I'm lucky, I won't die. And, you know, live to see the next day, in which case I'll again be asked, do something, and then I'll pick another action. That's more like what happens, right? In fact, you can see that this happens in whenever an agent works in the environment. It didn't have too much time to deliberate before. The question is, how much time do you have for thinking versus acting? Okay, in some domain, you know, some scenarios, you have enough time for thinking that you can come up with an optimal strategy and then start executing it. In some domains, you don't have that luxury. So in general, we can start talking about real-time versions of search algorithms. Okay, I could have talked about real-time version of A-star search. I will actually now talk about real-time version of MDP, because if I do that, I would have talked also about real-time version of A-star search. Yes or no? Right? Okay, so what do I do for real-time dynamic program, real-time version of MDP? Basically, all you're going to do is, suppose I'm stuck in this state. I'm right now in this state. I'm trying to decide which state I should go to. I'll tell you the following idea. You know, you have a few seconds left. You know, I mean, like 3 minutes or something left, let's say, to make your decision. So I'll go and expand below this. Okay, what are the actions I can do? Below this, I can do A1 or A2. If I do A1, with probability P1, I will be in state S1. Probability P2, I'll be in state S2. If they do A2, I'll get probability P3 in S3, P4 in S4. Okay, and then now I'm in S1. I'm still thinking. So what happens if I'm in S1? If I'm in S1, I might have a couple of actions, and that will lead me to certain goals and so on. So suppose I have 3 minutes to think before I decide what action to do. Okay, I would say that spend about 2.5 minutes, and I'm just, you know, giving you some rough ideas, expanding this tree of possibilities. Go as far as you can go, okay? And if in fact every leaf node is a sink state, suppose you are in a particular kind of MDP where there are enough sink state, there are sink states, and then every leaf node is a sink state, then I would say that essentially, so you spend some time on, you know, generated this tree, and then there are leaf nodes. What I want to do really is start give values to those leaf nodes and back them up the tree. Okay, suppose I actually had, if I know the values for this state and this state, I have some estimates on these. Then I know what the value of doing this action is, which is P1 times this plus P2 times this. Right? And that's the expected value for doing action A1. And similarly, if I had estimates of this, then there would be an expected value for doing A2. Now this guy just needs to pick the max. You always pick the maximum utility. Right? Now if you go further down below it, the same thing. So expectation, maximization. Expectation, maximization. Expectation, maximization, all the way up to top. Now the question, of course, is why do you think that you will know the estimates of these guys and not those? In particular, if in fact you grew this tree all the way down such that every leaf node happens to be a sink node, then its immediate reward is the value itself. If not, you could, so the minimum thing you could do is, you know, the estimated value for a state could be its immediate reward. You can just, you know, say that. Okay? And if all those states are sink nodes at the leaf level, then their immediate reward is also their real value. And then when you go up, you will actually know the exact right action to do from SNet. If you didn't have enough time to go all that way, then essentially your decision is going to be dependent on how much error is there in getting the leaf node values correctly. Right? Okay? This is just a different way of looking at the world. Now, I'll do as much thinking as I can. Okay? And the basic idea is, why do you think going deeper essentially is helping you? This is what's called look ahead. You are looking ahead. Okay? You could have decided, well, you know, just I'm here, right? I will basically look at just these states, take their immediate rewards, and decide which action to do. But if there are any traps, if there are any big you know, it looks that immediate reward is okay, but then remember in that picture that we had, there were states whose immediate reward is only minus 0.04, but they were next to a state either with minus 1 or plus 1 value. So if you went a couple, one more level deeper, you would have known that, you know, a better estimate of the value. So look ahead improves the estimate. Okay, now this is called real-time dynamic programming. In fact, the Bellman equation that I showed you, right, in a couple of slides back, that Bellman equation, this sort of Bellman equation, these are dynamic programming equations. And the last time you saw it, by the way, is in Dijkstra's algorithm. Okay? The only difference between this and Dijkstra's algorithm is, in Dijkstra's algorithm, actions are all deterministic. Here, you can also have expectation over the, you know, because the actions are stochastic. So it's just a generalization of Dijkstra's algorithm. Okay? Now, so basically, you have dynamic programming, and so in a way, I would solve this real-time version of MDP is, I will go some levels deeper, figure out what the values are for those, you know, leaf-level states. Okay? What the values are for the leaf-level states, take it up. Now, here's an interesting thing. If this was not, if these actions all have deterministic outcomes, you still are doing RTDP, but you can give it a different name. You would call it RT A star, real-time A star search. Yeah? Okay? Now, if you're thinking about A star search, then what would you give as the values for the leaf nodes? H value. Okay? So in fact, estimates of values of any state are really H values. Okay? So real-time DP is, you know, is a very general idea that basically you do expectation maximization. Expectation maximization. Okay? And then you can do A star search with the same ideas. Okay, except there's this little tricky thing about A star search. In A star, you think of everything as costs. In MDPs, you think of everything as values. So if you want higher value, you maximize. If you want lower cost, you minimize. But that's just a minor issue. Do you see what I'm saying? You know, So in fact, if you do RTA star, then basically there will be heuristic paths for the leaf nodes, and then at each node above, you will essentially take the best F value, the lowest F value, and then you keep, so you take min at each level instead of max. But that's only because you're thinking of costs versus values. You can do A star search with values. That's not a hard thing to do. Okay? So if I have deterministic action, then RTDB basically becomes RTA star search, and this tells you how to do A star search in that, even in deterministic domains, if you only have a little bit of time and you need to figure out what the optimal action to do, you know, at least figure out what to do from this state by just going a few levels deeper. So this is look ahead. Okay, now what's interesting in this way of looking at things is, where else do you get real-time pressure? You get real-time pressure when the world is changing and you need to pick an action. Okay, but where else do you get it? One other way is, of course, the world is changing is the issue. So when does world change? If you go back all the way to the beginning of the semester, what's the meaning of the world is changing? Dynamic. Till now, we have not looked at dynamic worlds. We have looked at static worlds. In static worlds, you will have enough time. So when you are thinking, the world stops. And so you can come up with the optimal strategy and you start working in the world. Right? Now, in a way, we are essentially admitting that the world does change. The reason I have less time to, you know, think is because the world is changing and I have to make a decision before the world changes too much, that I'm no longer there. So these are dynamic. Now, among the dynamic worlds, you can differentiate between two types of dynamism. One is the big bad world is changing. So the nature basically is just changing, you know, around, and then I have to pick. That's what MDP is doing. Okay, essentially, after I do my action A1, nature picks which outcome will really happen. Nature picks which outcome will really happen. Okay? Now, the interesting question is, what's the other way of dynamism? You have a name, you know, for the person who is changing your world. That's your opponent. There is an adversary in the world. There is a cooperator in the world. Okay? If you can basically say, things are changing, I have no clue. Or I can say, you can say, well, there's this little kid who is going around throwing everything out. That's the my opponent, that's my culprit. So I need to model them, model their actions, and do the best I can. Okay, so the point is that I'm slowly going into adversarial search now. And by definition, adversarial search, you are more likely to have to make a move. You will not be given, you know, huge amount of time, because if you take too much time, they'll just go ahead and make their move, which will trump your move. Right? And if you think of, let's say, chess, 3 hour per move chess, it's like, you know, you can think about optimal strategy. Okay? A lightning chess, you're just making moves very fast. But either way, you know, essentially, the fact that there's an opponent, you know, dynamism, and, you know, becomes very important. Now, here is the interesting thing. If I had an opponent, suppose I do my actions. Now, just look at the same exact picture, right? And if you look at this exact picture, and under each of the actions there's only one branch, it becomes real-time A-star search. Right? But if it have multiple branches, in fact, they don't have to be just two branches. An action can take you to 15 different states with different probabilities. Right? And the question is, suppose when I do my action, right now I said I can go here or I can go here, and this is the probability of going here, this is the probability of going here. Suppose, actually, I realize that my opponent decides, after I do my action, my opponent decides which of the states I will fall in. Nature is your opponent too, but you somehow thought nature is a fair opponent. So you can do tests on the nature. In fact, how did you get these probabilities, P1 and P2? In the past, you did A1 multiple times in the nature and found that about probability P1, you get into state S1, probability P2, you get into state S2, if you ever do A1 from S init. That's how you learned the action model. Right? Now, if you think there is an opponent out to get you, and if you think nature is out to get you, let's say, then you cannot, if you think that nature doesn't really, you know, understand your presence, then you think it will continue doing the same thing. You know, next time around when you do action A1 with probability P1, you will come here, probability P2, you will come there. If you think nature is out to get you, then what do you think will happen? What are you supposed to do? If you're doing MDP, I argue that you should figure out which of these states is bad for you. And that's the one nature will pick. Because all nature is interested in doing is to get you. Now, how do you figure out which of these states is bad for you? Because you went down, as you are backing stuff up, you will know which of these states are bad. And you pick the bad ones. And then you maximize here. Did you understand what I'm just saying? So when you think the nature has, when you think that, you know, basically the nature is out to get you, then you have to, instead of expecting which one will come, you have to expect the worst, because the nature is really out to get you. And in an adversarial game, there is no nature. There is this other person who is out to get you. So if you don't want to lose the game, then you essentially have to consider that, figure out what are the values of these two states, and whichever is bad for you, that's the one the opponent will pick. Now, opponent may actually not be that smart, but if you do your reasoning this way, you are not going to lose the game. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay. So then what are you doing? Instead of expectation, maximization, you're doing minimization, maximization, minimization, maximization over the values. That's min-max search. That's what you do in game theory. Okay? Deep Blue does that. That's exactly what you do. Okay? So without further ado, next few slides, next several, you know, the rest of the class, I'll be talking about game tree search. So essentially, it's just RTDP. You can think of it as RTDP, except you don't think that, you know, the uncertainty would be resolved in an expected way. It will be resolved in a way that's most damning to you. Right? There is another option, which is you think, so there is min-max, right? But there is another option. You think you are the chosen one. The nature is out to help you. Or your mom or your dad is going to make the things for you. They are, you know, getting involved and, you know, making sure good things happen to you. Okay, I mean, recently I was seeing this Simpsons episode where, I don't know, I mean, if you see Simpsons, but there's this guy, Ned, who, you know, is a devout Christian and, you know, essentially he's taking part in this bowling game where he hits the thing and then one pin is left standing. And then Ned basically says, God, this is Ned, you know, looking up. And then God just makes that thing also fall. Not only that, it also hits, you know, he also makes, you know, Homer hit himself, you know. So if you are playing in a world where everything is up to help you, then you do max. None of us are privileged to live in that world, and so we don't do max search. But it has semantics. Ned should be doing max search. Okay? If you're playing chess with an opponent who you think understands chess, you should be doing min-max search. If on the other hand, you're playing chess with a one-year-old kid who thinks all the pieces are worth eating, right? And whenever your turn comes, you think 20 minutes to figure out what your best option is, then the joke is on you, not on that little kid. Because you modeled your opponent so badly, you're thinking this little kid, while trying to eat the chess pieces, is thinking what's the best move to do. Okay? So again, it's all about real-time search, and it's about what you expect of the opponent. Okay, so then we'll get into game trees. So basically, think of this as the bridge, just as partial satisfaction was the bridge to go from planning into MDPs. This is the bridge to go from MDPs into game trees, which is adversarial search. Okay, where you don't do expectation maximization, but you do minimization maximization. Okay. That's just, you know, chess is a great game which has that, you know, any board game with between two players has these kinds of properties. Even multiplayer board games have these properties. Okay, chess is a classic example, and so, and of course, there's even more classic example. I forgot to tell you this. I don't have the thing with me, but again, talking about Simpsons, there's this Indian guy in it called Apu, and Apu has gone to Springfield Academy of Sciences and has done a PhD, and then at which point he decided, you know, the best job he'll get after that is to open up a 7-Eleven kind of a store, which is Quickie Mart. Now, he did do a dissertation. How many of you know what his dissertation was? If those of you, what is the dissertation? What dissertation did Apu do? You should see, you should find out, but basically it's connected to this. Apu wrote one of the world's first tic-tac-toe programs. So there is this one particular show where he shows this huge big carton of punched cards and, you know, and say, this is my dissertation. Okay. So anyway, so tic-tac-toe is another classic case of two-player game with opponent. Okay, so we'll be thinking in the background about chess when we are doing our discussion from now on, but we'll be illustrating our methods mostly with tic-tac-toe because that I understand. Chess I don't. Okay, I mean I do, but you know, you don't want to learn chess from me. Okay, and by the time you're done with game trees, you will learn a really cute idea called alpha-beta pruning, which is a great technique that that works for game trees. Not for normal RTDP. So, although I went from RTDP and game trees becomes just a special case, there is this idea called alpha beta pruning that works well for the special case, but not for the general case. Okay, and in particular, if you think about this kind of reasoning, what do you think is the main parameter? What are the parameters that improve the accuracy of your decision? If you're trying to do this, you know, you're trying to figure out which direction to go from SNH, which action to do, and you know, grew this tree, and then you back down. What are the parameters that you do it and your friend also does it? What are the parameters that are going to change? Who's going to be more accurate in picking the decision? Depth, you go to. The other is the evaluation values you give to the leaf nodes. Those are the two. Right? And alpha beta, the reason it's interesting is it lets you go twice as deep with the same amount of time. Twice as, in the best case, alpha beta allows you to go twice as deep in the same amount of time. In the worst case, it just takes as much time as anybody else would have done. That's why it's a beautiful idea, because you know that to increase depth twice, you have to do exponentially worse normally. Right? But you're able to do it which about the same time. And okay, so that's the reason you should be interested in game trees. So that's basically, we will talk about, first we'll start talking about perfect play. In fact, even though I started here by saying the leaf nodes have values, now, as I said, one special case is all the leaf nodes become sync nodes. In the game tree parlance, what are sync nodes? Those are both positions that are definite wins, are definite losses, are definite draws. Everybody agrees that that's the case for them. And any other node is an intermediate board position. You can look at it and say, it's kind of looking good for the white, or it's kind of looking good for the black. Right? But there are certain positions you look at and say, yeah, a huge number of white pieces, a few black pieces, but white is dead because, you know, white's king has nowhere to go. They mate it. Right? So what we will first look at is thinking of, you know, min-max search with respect to, you know, going all the way to leaf nodes, and then understand alpha-beta pruning there, which is a beautiful idea. And, you know, it looks like magic, but it's very simple once you understand it. Okay. And then we'll start talking about how to give evaluation functions, game-specific evaluation functions for the leaf nodes, which are basically sort of heuristics for the leaf nodes, except, you know, they should have some game tree meaning, the game-specific meaning. Okay? Now, in general, just as single agent can be in a deterministic or stochastic world and can have full information as well as partial information, if you have games between multiple agents, they too can be in deterministic versus stochastic worlds, and they too can have complete versus incomplete information. Okay, chess, is it deterministic or stochastic? Is deterministic. What would make a game stochastic? Dice. You guys haven't played enough games. Okay, so dice, you know, you basically, you want to make a move, but first you have to throw a dice. You know, imagine snakes and ladders, the deterministic version of it. It's boring. Right? I mean, unless you don't have good eyesight and don't know how to go up on the ladder, you know, snakes and ladders without dice is boring. It's boring even with it, right? But it's definitely boring without it, right? Okay, so it's a deterministic game. I mean, snakes and ladders is a stochastic game. Okay, normally after stochastic means after the dice you get to decide what to do. In the snakes and ladders you pretty much do what the dice tells you. But in some other games the dice may still leave you open some number of options, and among the cards that are dealt with, I mean, the number options you have, you do the best you can. That's normal games with stochastic chance. Okay, so backgammon and monopoly are like that. Now chess, is it complete information or incomplete information? You have to think about it carefully. If you assume that I realize that I am there and my opponent is there, and neither of us can read each other's minds, then it's complete. You both know exactly the same amount about the game because the game board is in front of you. How many of you know? So whereas, what about something like poker? The whole point of poker is I don't know your cards and you are bluffing your way, right? That's an incomplete information game. Poker is actually both incomplete and stochastic because the cards that you are dealt randomly. Okay, so essentially games also can have these variations, deterministic and chance. And you know, so deterministic versus chance and perfect versus imperfect information, we'll mostly look at this area. So now we have gone from single agent to multi-agent, except we'll still stick to the deterministic side. The only stochasticity, only uncertainty is coming because you can't read your opponent's mind. Other than that, everything else is deterministic. Okay, how many of you know the name, a version of chess which actually has imperfect information? Yeah, I know. But it has a name. It's called a blind chess. That's a good idea, but there's a name for blind chess. It's called Kriegsspiel. Okay, so you don't get to see the game. You only get, I mean, basically the worst version is you don't even get to see the board position at all, and variations on it is you get only the partial information about the board position. Who do you think is most interested in Kriegsspiel? Military, right? If you remember, the game of chess started in India. It was called Chaturanga, okay? And it came because kings were interested in making battles with people. And then in these old days, they were like either like too naive or too crazy, but everybody will know exactly how the battlefield is situated. And all the guys, you know, of side A will stand here with their, you know, with their arms, and the side B will stand in front of them, and they just, you know, fall into each other, and you know, some people will get killed, some people will stay. That's more or less a perfect information game. I can see, and whoever has more people and who can, you know, do more killing will win. But that unfortunately has gone away, right? People actually no longer come in front of you, you know, when you go into some other country to invade it. They stand behind the doors. And you have essentially partial information. You know, if you think of the war theater as a board, which is what, you know, military wants to think, then it's not chess that they want, it's Kriegsspiel that they want. And most recently they had poured huge amounts of money on a program called DARPA, Real World Reasoning Program. And what do? They actually, that program basically worked on Kriegsspiel search, chess, and how to do it well. And that was like less than 2 years back. Okay, so there is connection to, you know, chess came from wars, and then the variations of chess like Kriegsspiel actually are very useful in war because you have incomplete information. But having said all that, I will focus here. And you still have interesting number of cases. chess, checkers, Go and Othello, they're all games. Okay, and it is interesting to say that there is chess, there is checkers, there is Othello, and there is Go. We'll talk about what is the state of the computer gaming, because we'll actually understand the computer strategies for playing these kinds of opponent games. We'll understand it. You already understand it right now. It's just min-max search. Okay. Where are we right now? It turns out that Othello and checkers, okay, humans don't want to play computers because it's not worth it. Humans don't actually try to get involved in a weightlifting competition with cranes, right? They gave up. That was the battle we lost, right? So, and similarly, they don't get into running competition with cars, you know. So they gave that up. So Othello and checkers are so totally beaten down by computer programs that it's not even funny. And tic-tac-toe is gone. I think it's gone as soon as you got out of grade school, okay? But it's definitely dead as far as chess, you know. The computers are obviously very good at it. Go, humans don't want to play with computers, but for the completely opposite reason, because they suck at it. You know, Go, I don't know how many of you know Go. If you are into Go at all, you know, talk to Will Cushing. He's crazy. He's spending all his time thinking about Go instead of doing research, but don't tell him that. But, you know, Go is a crazy game which has a humongous branching factor. Humongous branching factor. So you can think of a game in terms of the branching factor. How many actions can you do and how many outcomes can they have? And Go has just way too high a branching factor that there is no way even the best computers today can do it. Chess is in the sweet spot. It's already coming to a point that we really can't do too well against computers, because, you know, human champions are finding reasons why they don't want to play with the computers. You know, they're not saying we're too bad compared to them, but they still say, no, it's like in a Windows program, I don't want to play with Windows. You write it in Mac, I will play it, or something like that, okay? But anyway, chess is sort of in the sweet spot right now, okay? Actually, it was in sweet spot 5-6 years back. It's no longer really, but we'll humor ourselves because we are humans. We want to be good. Okay, so min-max. The way min-max game trees are written, you know, this is the notation we will use because that's the standard notation people use for game trees. Okay, but you should be able to see that this is essentially nothing but this. Okay, so basically I get to do actions A1, A2, A3, then my opponent gets to do one of these actions. If my opponent does it by, you know, throwing a dice, then I would know the probabilities that they will do these actions if I have modeled them. If I think my opponent is out to get me, then I would assume that it's nothing to do with the probability. They would know a lot about the game and they will do me the thing that's most bad for me. Even if it looks good for me right now, it's a trap and it'll be bad for me. Okay? And so because of which, it makes sense to take mins at the opponent level, maxes at my level, recursively. Okay? That's why it's called min-max search. Okay? So you don't use probabilities because the probabilities are bogus. Do you understand what I'm saying? You can get probabilities as to what is the probability that, you know, Kasparov uses this kind of a move, right? But that may not make any sense, because in the case where that move will kill you, they will with 1.0 probability pick it. It doesn't matter what the frequency was before, they will know that this is the most damaging to you, and that's why they're grandmasters. They will pick that for you and you'll be dead. And you would say, no, but you never picked this move before. You picked it with very low probability. How can you do it to me? And they'll say, that's the way it is, right? So that's why you don't care about the probabilities, because they're useless, essentially, okay? If you have an omniscient, rational player, then you may as well just ignore the probabilities, okay? If on the other hand, you're playing with a 2-year-old kid or 1-year-old kid who's trying to eat up the chess pieces, you may as well use probabilities. You know, and in fact, it's uniformly probable. And maybe you'll say, you know, the kid might like the horse, the knight more, so it will try to eat it more. So there's higher probability that the kid will try to eat the knife. You know, that's the modeling you do for the kid. Okay. Anyway, for the opponent with rationality, let's say I have extended. I'm here and I'm trying to figure out what should my move be. Move means my action. Okay. And I went ahead and expanded the tree. And in this case, you know, these correspond to board positions. You don't know what these board positions are. You know, if you basically, they can be chess positions, they can be tic-tac-toe positions, they can be go positions, and so on. Since all of these are terminating positions, that means everybody agrees that at this point the game is over. In each of these cases, the game is over. And then when the game is over, there's a payoff. And you always look at these things from the point of view of this player. This is our guy. He's max. Okay? And you're trying to get rid of, basically win over min. So these are the payoffs for the game. This is the utility of getting to these states from the point of view of max. And those are sink states, basically, because the game is over at that point of time. If that is the case, then which one should I do? Okay, now if I'm not careful, if I do naive reasoning, then I'll say, hey, there is a 14 here, so I should go here, because this will get me to 14. Right? That makes no sense, because, you know, there is also a 2 here. And if I go here, this guy will pick 14, 5, or 2. With probability 1.0, they will pick a 2. That's what I get to get. Right? So you really have to do minimization and maximization. So here, from this branch, normally, from this branch, I get a 3, because the minimum of 3, 12, and 8. From this branch, I get a 2. From this branch, I get a 2. Now, I take a max of all these, which is 3. So my value is 3. And my move is anybody who is giving me 3. In this case, this guy is giving me 3. If there are two guys giving me 3, I can take either of them. Okay? Right? That's it. That's basically game trees. And everything else is a little efficiency hack on top of it. Okay. Now, here's the question. How much space would I require? Assume I have the time. How much space would I require to do this search? This can be called min-max search. Okay? I showed you the entire tree up front, and then I propagated the values. If I do it that way, I would need exponential space. But do I really need the whole tree in front of me? Not really. Okay? Think about it this way. I will start from here. It's all thinking, right? So I'll start from here. I can do A1, A2, or A3. What's the way to do search such that space is reduced? Depth-first search. You do depth-first traversal of game tree. So what I'll do is I'll take A1, I'll get here, I'll realize that this guy can take D3. It's complete information. So I know what are all the options my opponent has. I don't know which one they will do, but I know what their options are. Okay? And then it's A11 is the first one, so I'll take this, and then I get a sync node. Then I have 3. At this point, now I can basically, there's no more to go. I have to backtrack. So I'll hold 3 and go up here. And then go down, I'll see a 12. I take a max of, a min of 3 and 12, which is 3. I'll hold it in my hand. I'll go here. I'll get an 8. Min of 3 and 8 is still 3. Now I'm done here. I go up here. And I'm holding 3 in my hand, max of something else and 3. So I'll hold 3 here and come down here, etc. If I do it, I'm doing depth first search. And I'll never need more than linear space. Right? But the way I was telling you this, there is actually one interesting point. You are keeping track of intermediate values. Remember when I came here, I said I'm holding 3. So in fact, let me show you the way. So you know, in this case, of course, you'll do this. But let me actually, and then one other point, of course, is, you know, a real game tree may look more like this. You know, this is the famous tic-tac-toe. Okay, so empty board, and then these are all the things that the min, you know, can do. I mean, these are all the things you can do. Then these are all the things min can do, etc. And here are terminal positions. And I leave it up to your superior tic-tac-toe knowledge to figure out that they are in fact terminal positions, right? Okay. Now, what I want to do is actually tell you, like as I said earlier, that I can do depth-first traversal of this tree. Okay, and let's see. So when I came from here, I first came down here, I saw 3, and I took min of 3 and some unknown quantity is what this guy's value would be. So I'm holding, this is 3 is the best I have found till now, and I'll hold it, and then whatever is the value here, what can you say is the relation between the value there and 3? Whatever is, so when I did not see this, you didn't know this, because if you're doing depth research, you don't know this. All you got was this is 3, and you came up back here, and you have a 3 in your hand. So what would be, this value would be at most 3. So its real value is less than or equal to 3. It's less than or equal to 3. Right? Okay. So the intermediate value I'm keeping, they're actually bounds. At the min level, they are less than or equal to bounds. And at the max level, they are the greater than or equal to bounds. The min level bounds are called the beta bounds. And the max level bounds are called the alpha bounds. Okay? Now, the interesting thing to remember is beta is always less than or equal to beta is what you're thinking of. And alpha is always such that greater than or equal to alpha. The terminology alpha and beta are not important. You need to realize that the intermediate values you get while you're doing depth first search are bounds. One is a lower bound, one is an upper bound. Okay? So for the min level, it's an upper bound. And it cannot go any more than 3. This guy will never, even if you didn't see this, as soon as I got a 3, I will never let anything which is better than 3, which is greater than 3, to escape from here. Because I already know to damage you at least to the level 3. Why would I, you know, not do it? Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay? So, having said that, so now of course I came here and then I went up here. This guy has seen one of its children. It's a 3. Right? So now he gets a bound. And that bound is greater than or equal to 3. Fine. Now I want to continue my search. And I'm just looking at this. This basically, this unbeknownst to you, the search algorithm, is the full tree. You don't see the tree. I mean, search algorithms never actually explicitly construct the entire tree. They only construct the part that is needed. The issue is, if you're pruning, the issue is, are there parts of the tree that you never have to even generate? If anybody tells you, well, you first generate, then you can prune it, you laugh at them because you already done the work. What you stop oftentimes, so for example, this is a thing like, you know, somebody, you know, like CIA, somebody can say, you know, I mean, insurance, you can go and, not CIA insurance, but, you know, CIA, you can tell CIA that, look, you guys are getting all this money and really what's there? You know, you haven't stopped anything. And they'll say, hey, there haven't been any terrorist attacks and that's because we've been doing our work. Right? It's like they don't have to bring a terrorist in front of you and, you know, let them show a, you know, a big bomb on you and then they stop it. Then you'll feel that they're doing some work. But if nothing bad is happening, partly it's because probably they're doing their job. And when you cut search, you would not even know how much you actually cut. Do you understand what I'm saying? You may know only if you happen to know if you happen to be an oracle and you know really the full search tree. Okay, fine. So I came here. And I'm coming down this side, and I came down like this, and I got a 2. That's 2 there, right there. You don't know that this is a tree, but you got a 2 here. So now, what happens here? I know that this is less than or equal to 2. Now, here is my question. I am actually about to go down further from this guy and find out their other children. Is there any point? Why isn't there any point? Because this guy already got a 3. You can do whatever you want here. In fact, this tree happened to be like this, but I can actually have a tree where this goes like that. It doesn't matter how big it is and how many plus infinities are there in the tree. You're not going to get it. Do you understand what I'm saying? You're just not going to get it. Okay? So, without having seen anybody below, I will say there's no way I will be part of the main line of play, so cut it. And I cannot emphasize this enough. You do not cut based on what happens below you. You cut based on what happened before you. If you cut based on what happened below you, that means you actually generated a search tree, and it's a wasted effort. And I'm saying this, and I'm sure all of you will do exactly what I said you shouldn't do, but you know, I have to try my best. Okay. So you have a cut here. At this point, in this tree, you were removed. You did not have to generate these two nodes. It looks like a small thing. But how do you know? I mean, I could have actually had a huge big tree here, and that was all cut too. And you did it without seeing it. That's alpha beta pruning. Okay? So then I go up, then I mean basically this has been cut, so now I go down there, and then in this case I got a 14 here, so that's less than or equal to 14. Can I cut? No. You can only cut if a beta is less than an alpha above it. It doesn't matter how above it. Remember, in the tree, if you are a beta, then there's an alpha above you, then there's a beta above you, then there's an alpha above you. If you here are less than this guy here, then you can cut below you. Okay, that's the deep alpha beta pruning. And this is one level alpha beta pruning, but the same principle. You just remember the path, you know, the current bounds. Okay, so you can't cut here yet. Now I get, there's a 5, now it's minimum of 14 and 5, it's less than or equal to 5, but you still can't cut because 5 is not less than 3. Now I get a 2, and now I have less than or equal to 2. At this point, you may say, I'm stopping because the tree is over. You don't know that. You can stop search for two reasons. One is there are no more children. The other is, in this case, you stop anyway because it's less than or equal to 2. Even if there were 10,000 more children here, you don't care about them. That's alpha beta pruning. Okay? So whenever a node gets its true value, its parent bound gets updated. When all the children of a node have been evaluated, are a cutoff below and occurred below that node, the current bound of that node is its true value. But it doesn't really matter. So you might say, I don't really know what the value of this guy is. Right? Yeah, who cares? You'll never need to know this because you're just trying to figure out what's the right thing to do here. It's true that you'll never know the value of this guy, but it'll never really affect the main line play. The reason you're doing min-max search is not to give correct values to each of the intermediate nodes, but to figure out what to do here. And then once you figure out what action to do, right, let's say in this particular case, you have decided at this point that I have figured out how to do this action, right? At this point, I will actually go ahead and do it. I'll do this action. Then it's your turn, you the min guy's turn. Min guy, if they were just as smart as I worried they were, they would actually have done this. If they're a little less smart, they would have done this. They're really dumb, they would have done this. Then I start from there and figure out what to do next. Do you see what I'm saying? Okay? And that's when basically all I needed to know is the correct value here and the correct direction here. And one of the interesting things is this alpha beta pruning technique only works when you have min and max, not with expectation. The interesting question is how much of the tree can be cut? As I told you, you know, if the alpha beta pruning is working in the real, normally when you're using it, you'll never know how much it improved. It's like, you know, you'll never know how many terrorist attacks, you know, somebody stopped because they didn't happen. But you might still, as a scientist, want to know, you know, construct scenarios and see how many of them, you know, could you have cut. So what really would be the maximum improvement alpha beta can get? Okay, now first thing I want to do is I'll leave this, I will not have time here, but I'll probably, you know, you should be able to do alpha beta pruning on this tree. I'll show you the answer next time. Okay, this is a different tree, this one goes at different depths. That's fine, normal, there's no real reason why everything has to go to the same depth. And you should be able to figure out your intuition by doing it on this. You know, just be like a machine, you know, just keep the bounds and you will be surprised at, you know, what things get cut. Okay, and I can always count on an alpha beta pruning in the final exam to kind of say nobody gets 100 out of 100. Right? I mean, somebody or other will, I mean, not everybody gets 100 out of 100 because somebody or other will make mistakes. Now, alpha beta pruning, is it a heuristic? It's not a heuristic. If you don't do it, you're just dumb. Do you understand what I'm saying? There is no badge in the world that you would get because you did this. Okay? This is like after when you're doing sorting, you already constructed a partial sequence which is already unsorted and you're trying to see if you can extend it to be more sorted. You're dead anyway. And similarly, it's like in a CSP, there's already a failure. You didn't catch it and you're expanding it to deal with the rest of the constraints. You're dead anyway. So it's just the right thing to do. It's not just, you know, heuristic. You know, it's just the right thing to do. Okay? Now, what is interesting about alpha beta search is how much can it cut, really speaking. Okay? And if you have a uniform tree model, and if the tree is in such a way that the moves at the max and min levels are in the optimal order. That means max moves are in their best order, min moves are in their best order, unbeknownst to you. That would be the best case that alpha beta would do. And then this is how the tree looks. Okay? And you should actually see if your intuition works with this. Notice, for example, all of this has been seen. Okay, because until you see this, you won't get a real value for this. Until you get a real value at one level, you don't get a bound at the next level. Okay, and once you get the bound here, hopefully, if this is the correct order, then as soon as you see one here, you will be able to cut this based on that bound. So everything dotted here is the stuff that you saved, unbeknownst to you, on the uniform tree. And if you figure out what you really wound up doing, you will realize that the number of nodes here is essentially of the order of b power d by 2. It's 2 times b power d by 2. Okay? Now, in a normal tree with branching factor b, how many nodes would be there at the depth d? B power d. Instead, you are now only having to deal with b power d by 2 nodes, which means given the same time, in the optimal case, you could have gone twice as deep. Okay? But for alpha beta to really work well, it should be the case that the tree is generated in the correct order. You generate this in terms of these, you know, you do one here, two here, three here, because that's the best expectation you have about how the final values will turn out to be. Since the final values are what you're trying to compute to begin with, you might think this is a chicken and egg problem. But you can use an evaluation function that you will be using at the final level anyway, and you apply it here and use that to find the right permutation for the children. So in a depth first search, you expand a node, you get a bunch of children, and then you don't have to go left to right. You just have to pick one permutation and stick to it. And you know, you will see the evaluation function and see max to min is the permutation I'll use at the max level, and min to max is the permutation I'll use at the min level. If I do that, then I can come close to this. Deep Blue uses alpha beta. Any game tree search uses alpha beta, because not doing it is like, might as well just, you know, I have so much computing power that I don't need brains. Okay, and you know, and the other interesting thing is, and this is the last thing I'll say, and you get to go home. There were a bunch of pictures of people I put in the beginning. Okay, that guy, Donald Knuth, he isn't well known for doing his AI research. A lot of you probably know. You know, Knuth has done great work in algorithms. He's one of the pioneering computer scientists. And I put him because he did that tree. He did the analysis of alpha beta pruning. Okay? And then, of course, Von Neumann actually came up with the min-max theorem. He basically started the whole game tree search direction. And those of you who have seen A Beautiful Mind, John Nash came after von Neumann and basically said that essentially there's some kind of equilibrium exists for any game. Okay, and then Claude Shannon talked about finite look ahead, which we didn't do today, but it's pretty obvious. Instead of going all the way until the point where everything is a leaf node, I mean, is a terminating node, you can decide to go to a finite depth and apply evaluation function at that depth, and then back up based on that. Okay, and then actually the idea of alpha beta pruning came from John McCarthy, who is, you know, another great computer scientist and who basically also invented Lisp, because he needed a reasonable programming language and invented Lisp. And he has done a lot of work on non-monotonic reasoning and logic. Okay, so, and then of course there are a bunch of humanoids doing chess. That's the other thing. Okay, we'll stop here. Next time when I actually meet you, which would be next Thursday, I will tie up a couple of loose ends on the game trees and go into learning. Thanks for coming.